and expect to restructure that framework in a way that it can promote effective online contact with citizens of the state of Oregon, the agencies of the state of Oregon. And then the last one I'd like to underscore here is improving the use of geographic information systems. We have a POT package that we'll talk about later on in here, and we see more effective use of geographic information systems being a thing that we really ought to do to improve information access for agencies that need that type of information.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cromwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dugan, I just want to back up for a second to the bullet about creating enterprise architecture, including security and related standards. Is this something that you're looking at as being a modular type of system so that it can be added to and moved around as needed to meet the needs from a standpoint of the from a standpoint of not only the applications but the security and the changes that are constantly occurring in the security realm?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crummell, what we're talking about in this bullet is an overall enterprise architecture that would incorporate a security architecture, really any government architecture. Technical architecture for things like the data center would fit into this, but we want to have an overall framework and methodology for the architecture that meets the business needs and have those architectures understood so that they integrate with one another and not be inconsistent or opposing one another.
So, follow up, Mr. Chair. So would that be I guess it's been referred to as an N architecture type of configuration?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crummell, I can't answer that. I can get back to you with information about what type of architecture it is. We are early in the development of the architecture at this point. We're working with Gartner. We've got a community of practice team that's looking at the architecture. They're looking at business, and they're looking at the overall enterprise architecture. So at this point, we're trying to develop a framework that those individual architectures below it can take place under. So I'd be happy to get back to you with additional information about that if that would be helpful.
That's fine. One more follow-up, Mr. Chair. In the 05 session, we worked on a piece of legislation, 3485, was that the number? I don't remember the number, but anyway, in which we were looking very seriously at the security realm. Excluded from that was were some of our independently elected officials who feel that they might not be part of the executive branch except when it's convenient, specifically the Secretary of State and the Treasurer and the Attorney General's office. Is that, in terms of the architecture and specifically the security, is that going to be folded into the overall architecture that you're looking at for the system?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crummell, HB 3145, I think, was the bill.
Yeah, I think that's
We have published regulations about that bill. We can cover those agencies that are subject to DAS authority under any standards or architecture that we develop related to security. Others may choose to use that, but we can't compel them to use that.
So, clarification, Mr. Chair?
Correct.
So, in terms of the architecture, does that mean that those particular agencies would potentially be excluding themselves so that they're not necessarily included in the overall architecture that you're looking at creating?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crummell, I think if they're not specifically subject to DAS authority, then they would have the option of deciding to do something different. However, it's been our experience so far in this area that that those agencies aren't necessarily disposed to going it alone. If we have a structure in place that will make sense for them, I wouldn't be a bit surprised if they would take advantage of that.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, if you'll turn to page 322, we'll get into policy option packages. And the first policy option package is...
Let me stop. Here a little bit and see if we can enlighten the chair a little bit about what's gone on here in this whole world of IT as far as the agency is concerned. We've got a substantial amount of money that's being invested in one way or another in this. In addition to that, we've got a couple of different segments of the agency that this whole subject comes up in, namely the data center and then this thing here. And I wonder if I could ask the director to enlighten me a little bit about why we have gone to the problem of complicating or putting our administrative structure where we have two different departments dealing, seems to me, with somewhat the same topic, the data center versus the enterprise information resource management.
Chair Jensen, members of the committee, it was felt by let me back up a little bit. When the planning for the data center started back in 2003-2004, the decision was collectively made by the 12 agencies, the executive branch, and also the legislature then in 2005, that the data center would be split away and be a standalone entity because it is a service to the 12 agencies that it has housed inside it. And it was a feeling by the governing board that that would serve those 12 agencies better rather than have it sitting in Information Resource Management Division at that time versus what we have today with the Enterprise Division. That's the basic line as to why that was split out.
Okay. Let's go ahead to your policy packages.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 322, we have the first of two policy packages, package 454, which is the Information Resource Management Division reorganization.
On 450 who?
I'm sorry, 422. Page 322.
I have 452 on my thing right here.
Package 452. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Mr. Chairman, package 452.
That's fine.
It abolishes 10.5 FTE, 10 positions, and it transfers 154 positions. 34 of those positions remain with the Enterprise Information Strategy and Policy Division. If you turn to page 323, this package links the two key performance measures, first being customer service. And in my presentation on Thursday, I talked about the low customer service scoring, customer satisfaction by agencies of the IR&D division. It was at 48% for overall customer satisfaction. This reorganization really allows the Enterprise Information Strategy and Policy Division to focus on policy, to focus on strategy, and to carry out those key initiatives around security, around business continuity planning, around geospatial information, and e-government, without taking limited resources and having to focus on the urgency of the scenic work that took place.
You're transferring 154 positions.
Yes.
From where?
they, Mr. Chairman, the positions leave what was the Information Resource Management Division. 34 of those go to the Enterprise Information Strategy and Policy Division, this division. A number of them go to the to the state data center. A number of positions go to the operations division, which has the help desk function that came out of the old information resource management strategy division. It also has an application development group. A large number of these positions, and I don't know the number exactly, but it could be as many as 100, maybe over 100, go to the state services division as a part of the publishing and distribution program that was also located in IRMD. So those four divisions are the recipients of the positions that were in the former IRMD. And at the end of the day, once those are all transferred out, there's a net reduction of 10 positions that are being given up in this budget.
Right.
I know. And the last key performance measure that this links to is IT governance, which we have talked about last week. On page 326, we have policy option package 454, which is the Navigator program. This program really takes a lot of different geographic information systems that are being compiled by different state agencies, information compiled by the federal government, information compiled by 24 of the 36 different counties, and it begins to put it in a single repository that all of those governing agencies can access. So it's really the idea of collecting this information, putting it together in some kind of a way that's easily accessible by agencies that need that. It will enable consistent and efficient statewide geographic information sharing and maintenance. It provides statewide geographic information services that will meet the needs of citizens of the state. It will increase the efficiency and productivity of government agencies that utilize geographic information systems. And it does such things as help in terms of emergency planning, emergency preparedness, to give those agencies that have a responsibility for that kind of work access to geographical data that they can use in an effective way for planning and response. On page 327, a couple of points I'd like to highlight here. This really is based on a partnership between local governments, tribal state governments, and really federal agencies that would come in and utilize it. And it builds on existing networks and systems that already exist. So it's not creating a bunch of new networks, but it's building additional data that would be accessed by them. And I should point out, too, that it's fairly proven technology. What we've got here is geographic information systems that we've been using this for 30 years. It works. It's not new technology. It's not high-risk technology. But it's beginning to capture this data and fill in the gaps that are in this existing data.
By that, you mean it's beginning to get very expensive.
Well, it's expensive in the way it is expensive, Mr. Chairman, in the way that it's captured now, and there's a lot of redundancy and duplication, and there are gaps in the information, so we don't get a holistic view of the state. So with this, we would begin to work on the high priority data sets to fill in those gaps, build them so that over 700 agencies across the state, local, state, county agencies utilize this information, that they would have a way to get to this information and use it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dugan, I know I've asked this question at JLCIMT, and I think it would be helpful to the committee for you to kind of explain it here, because many of them may not have the background from JLCIMT. The private sector currently, I mean, I can take a, you know, go to Costco and buy a Garmin GPS system and plug it into my car, and it'll tell me where to go. I know that there's some agency folks that would like to tell me where to go too, but how is this going to differ? And you can, on the computer, you can go on to Google, and it will give you aerial views and show you buildings and all of that kind of stuff. So it really, I mean, there's a lot of information that's already available in the private sector. So And I would wonder if the cost wouldn't be a lot less to be able to tap into those types of systems. So can you kind of help us understand why it is that we need to spend what appears to be about $5 million developing our own system when the private sector has already developed a system that is very easily accessible by anybody on the planet?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crummell, those systems are pretty neat. Some of that information actually comes from the kind of information that's captured by these systems. For example, the street address information, the Definity place for street addresses would be the data that's kept by county. So a lot of that information comes from these existing systems. If you look at some of those, if you go in Google Earth and you look at what you've got there, there are gaps in some of that information, and just like there are gaps in some of the information that we have. Plus, much of the information that we're talking about, there are really 14 different frameworks that we're talking about here. Land ownership information, transportation, hydrography, administrative boundaries, elevation, aerial, geodetic control. Those kinds of data, that kind of information, isn't readily available from the kind of systems you're talking about. So this is more detailed information that needs to be used by state agencies, city governments, counties that have to make decisions based on data. This gives them a better data set to make those decisions on.
If I may, Mr. Chair?
Please, sir.
Would it make sense to partner with the private sector so that where the gaps occur, we could work together to fill those in so that the private sector benefits as well as the public sector, and therefore drive down the costs of potentially both partners?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crummell, that's exactly right. It does make sense. There, as I understand it, there's a fairly significant presence of businesses in the state who operate geographic information systems, and we see part of how we move forward with here is partnering with private sector organizations to gather data and put it in here. So it's a broad partnership, not just with local governments and the federal government, but it's also with the private sector as well to fill some of those gaps and share that information. So, Mr. Chairman, if you...
Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Chair Jensen. Devin, one of your bullet points here is to increase efficiency and productivity of government agencies in Oregon. I have no doubt that this GIS program would do that. Is there some way that you can quantify that or get a high-level idea of the potential savings for the various agencies in the state of Oregon by producing this?
Mr. Chairman, in 2006, a business case was developed on this, Mr. Chairman, Senator Whitson, sorry. There was a business case developed around this navigator system, and they took a look at county, city, and state agencies. And if my memory serves me correctly, about $10 million, I think it was a biennium, was spent by state agencies in developing geographic information. But they're developing this information for their particular unique purposes. And so some of that development must continue to go on to fill in the gaps. It needs to be shared. That business case did show that there would be savings in efficiency and productivity related to local governments as well as state agencies, and we can share that business case with you.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. I still don't have a plausible explanation about why it is that we are developing a GIS system in revenue. You guys are doing another one. And as all I hear is they're developing it for their unique application. Tell me how these interface and why it is that we ought to be tolerating unique applications anywhere. The GIS data is the data, and we ought to be able to figure out how to let multiple agencies manipulate it in a way that delivers the product to them that they need. I need to have those two reconciled.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, this system is an attempt to begin to do that reconciliation. It's not an attempt to do the work that agencies have their responsibilities to do with the applications that they're doing now, but it's an attempt to partner in gathering that data and putting that data together so that it can be accessed for everybody's use and eliminate some of the redundancy and duplication by having those unique systems. Because, Senator Johnson, you're exactly right. I mean, the data is the data. And once that's captured, the facts will be the facts. We have spent time over the past year and a half or so developing standards for capturing that data that will allow it to be interchangeable and interoperable.
Follow up.
That sounds great. Does revenue sit on your committee? They have a whole unit over there that's doing this.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, we have an advisory group called the Oregon Geographic Information Council. It's made up of state agencies, some federal agencies, and local governments, and revenue is a part of that council.
Follow.
A consistent theme that I've heard as early as this session is how difficult it is to drag information out of the counties, some counties. How are you doing getting information from them?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, that's an excellent question because that can be difficult at times. Our geospatial manager, Cy Smith, has spent most of this fall and early winter visiting counties and local governments with a series of meetings around the state talking about the partnership and working towards building consensus around data sharing. We found three sticking points with these agencies that we continue to need to work on to resolve. One of them is funding. How do we manage to have stable funding for this system? And why that's a key issue is because the counties, as you may recall, and the cities have the ability to charge for this data. And so it is a revenue source for them, and they're nervous about losing that revenue source. So we have to work with them in a way that we don't jeopardize a revenue source, but that we collect the data and they have access to the data without costing them more or losing a revenue source for them. The second issue that we heard from them is concern about privacy. They're worried about us in this system disclosing owner information or privacy information that would be inappropriate to disclose. And so that's a system that we would work on with the agencies and come to agreement around what the protocols are on confidentiality of that information.
Well, now I'm really struggling. Disclose what kind of confidential data? The meets and bounds of somebody's lot?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, no, it wouldn't be the meets and bounds of their lot, but it might be who the people are or some condition about a location or geographic area that would be privileged information.
Like what?
It could be information about the individual, or it could be the individual who resides in an address so that this information wouldn't go out where somebody would then have access to a bunch of neighbor addresses.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess here's my big problem. I'm very sympathetic to the fact that the counties are struggling. Some are struggling especially hard. I have been a great proponent of counties. But this has got to be a two-way street, or we are creating data systems with giant holes in them. And I guess I just don't buy the argument that local government is here saying, partner with us, help us, anticipate what our needs are going to be when $400 million of federal money disappears, and yet they won't provide the data. And I don't buy the argument of privacy. I mean, if revenue is building it for state purposes with the idea of dealing with taxes, I think privacy can be guarded. It's guarded in all sorts of applications. And I just reject the premise that there's something so secret that a county can't cough it up for the use of either the Department of Revenue or for the kind of work that you're doing, or ultimately the benefit that will flow out of a GIS system where theoretically at any counter in any land service development office, you ought to be able to hit the button and know exactly what the layout of that place looks like with correct data and lots that actually line up on the face of the earth the way they line up on the data. I just don't buy it. And I can tell you that I am going to be unwilling to support a policy option package of this magnitude that doesn't have some of these fundamental questions clarified. It is not good enough to have ways and means just keep pumping out the money for these programs, and we find there are these massive disconnects. And I forgive me for feeling particularly grumpy on a Monday, but I am. The fact that education says this far down the line, I'm sorry, we have proprietary secret stuff that we can't be part of the scenic. And now all of a sudden counties, we have secret proprietary stuff, we can't be part of this. Either we as a state get it together and get the benefit for our citizens, or we stop spending money on these programs that look like Swiss cheeses with so many holes in them. I'm just annoyed about it. I'm done now, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. With that, we'll wrap up this, and I know that Representative Crummell wants to weigh in, but we'll have a lot of time. Okay.
Well, Mr. Chairman, then that does pretty well wrap up policy option package 454. I would like to say that when we talk about linkages on key performance measure, not only does it link to our key performance measure number one, but in looking at the 0507 key performance measures of state agencies, there are 28 agencies with 140 key performance measures that address the kinds of issues that Navigator would help them with, because they do need to capture this kind of information and use it in their applications. And finally, on page 331, the efficiencies that would be proposed would be the reduction of one operations position, director of operations position, in the Enterprise Information Strategy and Policy Division. And with that, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my presentation.
Okay, thank you. Concluding question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much.
Committee.
Yes, Senator.
Mr. Chair.
Let me make sure the Jane Smith is coming up. Go ahead, Senator.
Two things occur to me. One of them is that when we get ready to actually work this budget, it might be very helpful to have some of the parties to these projects come in here and explain why it is that they will or won't be cooperative. And secondly, I was thinking about this for my committee as I was watching this morning unfold. Seeing these policy options in isolation by program unit, I don't think gives the committee quite the same flavor as seeing all of the policy option packages for the whole agency in one place. And I know that that display exists, and I presume, or at least I'm asking Dallas, when we get ready to do the work session on this, seeing them all together I think is very useful. And I would just ask the chair's consideration to let us have that display.
Thank you, sir. So noted. We'll try to have staff.
We have that summary sheet that I'll pass out to you. If that would, I think that would be helpful because it has all of them enumerated.
Good morning. Now that that the information technology has gotten the committee warmed up, we're ready to take on the Office of Health and Policy Research. Ms. Smith.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Dr. Janine Smith. I was recently confirmed as the administrator for the Office of Health Policy and Research, having served under Dr. Bruce Goldberg as the deputy over the last 4 to 5 years. The office is responsible for the development and analysis of health policy in Oregon and serves as a policy-making and monitoring function for the Oregon Health Plan. We provide a technical analysis and policy support to you, the Legislative Assembly, and the Governor on issues relating to health care costs, utilization, quality, and access. You may wonder why we're in the Department of Administrative Services, but in the early days of the Oregon Health Plan, it was felt that by sitting outside of the Department of Human Services, we could provide a non-biased oversight and evaluation and analysis function. We work closely with the Department of Human Services and the Division of Insurance in the Department of Consumer and Business Services. We produce a reports regularly to you, and we're about to release our trends in healthcare analysis. We just got the new uninsurance numbers last week, and you'll be receiving those very shortly. Turning to our presentation in 334 is an overview of our organizational chart. We're a fairly small division within DAS. And on pages 335, I was going to talk about the various components of our organization.
go ahead. I'll save the question for a minute then.
The office carries out its work in a variety of ways. We have statutorily required data collection, monitoring, and policy analysis functions, which are sort of our core functions statutorily required, include an impact analysis of Oregon Health Plan policies, Oregon's uninsured, healthcare facilities, and healthcare trends and analysis. In addition, we staff several statutorily required healthcare advisory commissions and committees. And these are outlined starting on page 335 and carrying on to 336. The four main ones are the Health Policy Commission, which is just completing a strategic health reform plan for the next 5 years as directed by the governor, and working closely with your vice chair, Senator Bates, as Senate Committee on Health Reform. We also have the Health Resources Commission, which reviews new medical technology, particularly prescription drugs, that determine their effectiveness, and then provide that information to Department of Human Services to make the best choices in purchasing drugs for the Medicaid program. Each of these commissions have about 10 to 11 citizen volunteers. Many of them are healthcare professionals. Turning to page 336, we also staff the Health Services Commission, which outlines the state's priorities in determining which health care services we will pay for in the Medicaid program, with its famous prioritized list of health care services. Again, your vice chair was a founding member of this commission prior to his service in the legislature. We are the only state in the country with such a list. We also have been given the task of staffing the Medicaid Advisory Committee over the last biennium, which is required under federal law to provide advice and recommendations to the health plan. It has spent most of the last year developing recommendations for the governor's Healthy Kids program, and our office helps set up and staff statewide public meetings with families to provide some information back to the Medicaid Advisory Committee when they develop their set of recommendations. Turning to
Chair,
Representative Cromwell.
Thank you. I'm looking at something here, Dr. Smith, and it's just sort of gnawing at me a little bit. Under your bullet with regards to the Health Services Commission, prioritizes, regularly updates the list of health services, and based on best available evidence, which saves the state an estimated $32.5 million per year in general fund. Also creates evidence-based practice guidelines for services provided under Medicaid. There's two questions that really come up with that. The first one is, if we're saving an estimated $32.5 million per year in general fund, why did we have to come back here in special session last spring to bail DHS out as far as Medicaid services were concerned, to the tune of about $80 million?
Chair.
I'll let you answer that question, and then I'll get to my second one.
Okay. Chair Jensen, Representative Crummell, the $32.5 million is based on compared to other states who do not have a list. This is what we're saving every year. If we did not have a prioritized list, we would be spending an additional $32.5 million. And I have a detailed analysis from the director who put that number together for me that I can provide to you.
Thank God for lists, Mr. Chair. So my second question, if I may, Mr. Chair, is creates evidence-based practice guidelines for services provided under Medicaid. What that tells me is that there is a way that the states, if I'm a practitioner, the state's going to tell me what I can and can't do in terms of treating a patient. Now, if I have a patient that has, let's take something like fibromyalgia, which is really tough to treat. It's kind of all over the board, and every patient reacts differently. But if you have your evidence-based list there of things that I can do to treat that patient, but a particular patient that's on Medicaid falls outside of that evidence-based in terms of efficacy, and I do something else, and it's not on the list, basically I'm not going to get paid for it, am I? Or I'm going to have to, you know, call up somebody and spend hours arm twisting until I finally do get 40% of what my normal charges would really be, which means that there's really no profit in me seeing Medicaid patients. Am I correct in that?
Chair Jensen, Representative Crummell. The guidelines are recommended primarily for the fee-for-service population that don't have a managed care plan. The managed care plan, which is about 80% of the Medicaid program, oversee, you know, what is paid and what isn't paid to their provider network. So you can, you know, petition back to, say, Care Oregon or Providence or and ask them, you know, if you could get paid for using doing a treatment alternatively to the that outlined in the prioritized list. Also, if you have a there's a comorbidity, there's a situation in which if you have another condition and this particular condition would somehow deteriorate the other condition that is paid for, then you can appeal and get payment for that as well. The idea, though, behind the list and the premise of the list was that we would pay for the most effective treatment, and if there really isn't really well established effective treatment for the particular example you gave, fibromyalgia, unfortunately, at this state of art. We wish there was, but there are certain things that just are not effective, and there's no evidence. This, you know, came around at the very beginnings of the health plan when we were debating over certain transplants, whether it was very experimental and whether we wanted to spend all our dollars. And the will of the land at that time was to prioritize that we would pay for those things that had the most evidence to suggest that they were effective and worth the value of spending taxpayers' dollars on. So it is cause some discontent with some of the providers in the sense that they're doing things that may not be reimbursed. However, ideally, you want to shift the practice towards the most effective care, making exceptions where possible and where it is medically prudent to do so.
Mr. Chair, one of the things that while this all sounds really good in theory, when you get actually into a practice, it's a whole different ballgame. And quite frankly, one of the reasons why we lose providers under this system is because they don't have the flexibility. And when they do have a situation where they're trying to get paid for doing something, it is so onerous. The system is so onerous to try to work your way through that by the time a practitioner or even their staff spends all of their time trying to get paid, any incentive that might have been there to treat the patient is gone. It's out the window. And I can certainly understand why many of our practitioners are saying, you know what, I'm not going to see Medicaid patients. I don't want to see Medicaid patients. And managed care system that Dr. Smith was talking about, in some respects, it's even worse.
So Medicaid patients go to the ER room where they get the cheap services.
Right.
Please proceed.
Finishing on that page 336, the Medicaid Advisory Committee, as I mentioned, has been developing the Healthy Kids Plan and working closely on working with the Medicaid agency. Moving on to page 337, we also house the Oregon Prescription Drug Program. It is through bulk purchasing. It provides discounts to the uninsured and public government groups when they purchase prescription drugs. This was recently expanded to include all age groups. Previously had been just for those above the age of 54. However, with the passage of Measure 44, it is now available to all uninsured.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
How well is that plan rolling out?
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, I knew you would ask that question, or somebody would. We have about 5,000 enrollees as of the end of December. We have boxes and boxes and boxes of applications that have been rolling in since Measure 44 passed, and we're aiming that we'll probably be about 10,000 by the end of I think if we finally get the numbers in for January. The program was approved in the 2003-2005 session. We hired the administrator about 2004, and it's initially started March 2005. Again, it was before those above age 54, and then we had Medicare Part D rollout, so it was kind of, you know, not a little more confusing for seniors in that age bracket to know what to do about that. But now with the Measure 44, we feel that we can expand and get a lot more of the uninsured included in the discount. They get about $28 per prescription savings, and we've also been trying to work with the public groups, and we think now, just announced, I think last month, was the consortium with Washington State, and with that larger bulk purchasing pool, we should our prices should be even more competitive to be able to inspire more of the public groups to join as well.
Mr. Chair, well, let me ask my question with more specificity. If I'm eligible and I send in my form right now, how long until I get my card back or my notification that I'm in?
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, starting February 1, we just converted to a new company, ODS, that's been managing, and you should be able to sign up and get your card within 10 to 14 days.
Okay, so if someone's waited 3 months with no callback, that's anomalous?
Chair Jensen and Senator Johnson, ideally, yes, and we'd love to hear who that was. We've been bombarded with phone calls ever since the Measure 44 passed, and so we've been trying to keep up with that, and we have a 1-800 number, and we'd really like to know if there's someone who's having trouble.
Thank you.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Chair Jensen. Dr. Smith, I'm going to back up just a little bit to perhaps the Health Policy Commission, but in the last legislative session, we created a vehicle for producing about 80% of the Oregon Health Plan participants would have to be in an HMO in order to reduce costs. In the implementation of that, the Department of Human Services apparently did it by zip code. At least they did in North Lake County. And I would wonder about the policy of first of all, by doing it by zip code, and secondly, by selecting a place where if you are not able to go to the North Lake Clinic anymore, it's 2 hours one way to a physician in good conditions. In the wintertime, it's forever both directions. That policy decision would also have closed the North Lake Clinic before it's even totally constructed. We did get that straightened out, but, I mean, sometimes well-meaning legislation does not get implemented. And in this case, the policy was really inappropriate.
Representative Jensen and Senator Whitsitt, those are the kind of things that that's the role of the office is to try to better understand, you know, when policies are implemented, what happened. And that's the reason we exist. It's hard to stay on top of every single administrative role that the Oregon Health Plan creates over in the Department of Human Services, but we do try to follow and monitor as best we can, and trying to understand the access and availability of and not to avoid those and help advise them to the away from problems like that.
Then was a policy established by your agency to prevent that from happening, to address that situation and prevent it from happening again in rural areas and other frontier areas in Oregon?
Representative Jensen and Senator Whitsitt, that particular issue I cannot say that we've had addressed at this point in time, but we continue to try to stay abreast of what's happening when there were cuts to the program. We've been surveying who've fallen off and why they're not getting care and where they're not going. We've looked at whether we saved money or didn't save money when we thought we were. But some of those smaller, more local issues we probably have not had a chance yet to evaluate. But we will.
The situation in North Lake County was that in order to have the clinic maintain its federal grant, it had to be on a fee-for-service basis. So when you just simply, or when the agency simply wrote them off as a zip code, it destroyed the ability of that North Lake Clinic to support itself mm-hmm. through federal funding, and basically would have completely destroyed it. I'm reasonably certain that's not the only frontier area that has that problem. So I would hope that you would look into it.
Thank you. Please, I think we've got 12 minutes.
Okay. I'll move on to page 338, 39, 40, and 41 outlines what we, some of the accomplishments we've been able to do over the last two years. Some of those I've touched on regarding the Health Policy Commission, the Health Resources Commission, 339, again, the health services and the Medicaid advisory. And on page 340, the prescription drug, I would just highlight that we also initiated some efforts around coordinating state health information technology. We did completed a statewide inventory of how many providers are starting to adopt electronic health records. And we, as part, the funding for this came through a one-year grant that we contract with a national collaborative around how can we secure health information security and privacy and what kind of standards are we going to use as we convert from a paper world to an electronic world. And last on page 341 are the types of analysis we have done over this year.
Thank you, Chair Jensen. Going back to the Oregon Prescription Drug Program, could you come, you know, you have an enrollment of over 10,000. Can you compare that to, like, Walmart Corporation and their new plan and how many people they have enrolled and compare the state program to the private sector program?
Representative Jensen, Senator Whitsitt, I'm not familiar with where Walmart is at this point since they just rolled that program out with a discount, $4, I think it is, for generics program is what you're referring to. We potentially can have 1 million Oregonians on our plan, and as I said, there's about a $28 savings or about 50% of the cost of a drug savings, both brand and generic. So there's a little broader availability of drug choices in the Oregon Prescription Drug Plan than the Walmart four or five. I think they have a limited formulary of certain drugs that they'll provide for a discounted price. This has a network of 200 to 300 pharmacies across the state, and you don't have to go to Walmart to do it. You can go to your local small pharmacy if your pharmacy is participating. So there is a bit of a difference between the two programs. They're both attempts to try to get prescription drugs to those who don't have prescription drug coverage so that they will, you know, take their blood pressure meds and their diabetes meds and stay healthier. In the long run, there's significant savings for the state in terms of decreased uncompensated care in our emergency rooms as a consequence.
Sure, would it be worthwhile to get comparison of the numbers of people being served, the relative costs of those programs, to see whether the state is actually competing with a private enterprise here, and whether they, if they are, if they're doing so successfully.
Thank you.
Going back to page 341. Talk about the multiple surveys we're doing. We did the Children's Access Survey. This information went to Senator Mona Anderson's Interim Committee on Children's Health, as well as the governor, to help craft the Healthy Kids initiatives. And we've also been working with the Oregon Medical Association and the Department of Human Services to look at physician workforce. And we have a study in the field just as we speak. Moving on to 342, as part of DAS, we focus on the similar four primary goals that you've seen all of last week.
Sure. Yeah. May I ask a question that doesn't have to be answered here, but if you could answer later?
What that is that in reading through the material here on page 339, I'm really interested in under the Health Services Commission to reprioritize the list of greater emphasis of chronic conditions and preventive care.
Has there been a look at, you know, the dentists sort of had it right a whole many years ago when they said, you know, if you go for preventive care, then we're going to pay for, you know, restorative care that you may need to have, and if you don't, then we won't. I should say the dental insurers. Has there been a look at that type of model within the general health care system? And if there has been a look, what does it point to? I mean, what are the indicators? And if there hasn't been, would it be worthwhile to take that kind of a look? And that's why I say you don't need to try to answer that question now, but I'm just wondering if we could maybe respond later. Thank you.
Representative Jensen and Representative Krummel will get back to you on that.
Thank you.
In the essence of time, I will move forward. The strategic plan is outlined on page 343. Our customers are you, the governor, the healthcare stakeholders, advocates, and citizens, and our goal is to ensure excellent customer relations. 344 outlines some of our, we want to deliver our information back to you in a timely and accurate manner. 345, we hold at least 130 public meetings a year between the various advisory commissions that we staff and their and committees and their various subcommittees, as well as the statewide public meetings that we do periodically. And we try to network with as many of the healthcare stakeholders and advocates to share information and bring them together. Page 345 outlines those efforts. And 346, cost containment is very key to us, both in what we do to help contain costs elsewhere in the healthcare system, as primarily for the state, and also what we try to do to save money for our own in our own programs. And as I mentioned, the OPDP provides some savings per prescription for uninsured Oregonians, the prioritized list, etc. And the strategic plan is concluded on 347. Moving on to page 348, those are the DAS statewide measures, of which OHPR participates in the KPM number 1, customer service, and KPM number 15, which is a new one that was just created this last interim session, with our goal of surveying the key healthcare policy stakeholders this year, aiming to fulfill our goal of providing useful, objective, and reliable healthcare information. Turning to page 351, it outlines our particular performance measures. We currently are about 83% on our customer satisfaction based on the last DAS customer service, and we're aiming for higher, 90%. And then, as I said, the KPM number 15 is new, and we aim for 80% there.
Senator Johnson.
If the legislature is in part your customers, do you survey the legislature with respect to your performance?
Representative Jensen, Senator Johnson, yes, we did the KPM, the key performance measure, was developed with that in mind, that we would do that at the end of this session to see how we did in terms of performance. We did a small pilot of that about a year and a half ago to the members of the various health committees during the last session.
Thanks. I'll see you.
Thanks. And their staffers. 352 is the prioritized list within that you requested within our office. Basically, this is sort of delineated more by our two types of core functions and our special projects. Both have statutory required components. Moving on to page 353 is our 0709 budget drivers. The one thing about our office is we do not receive assessments like the rest of DAS. We primarily live off of general fund, and the general fund is leveraged when we can and when it's appropriate to get federal matching dollars from the Department of Human Services. So for every dollar we can that is appropriately used for a Medicaid-related activity, we can get a second dollar by working sending it over as a special payment to DHS. They send it back to us as other funds. If you cut a dollar of general fund, we lose $2 out of our budget. So it very determines our budget quite a bit. In addition, we try to get as much support from outside sources, grant dollars. If it's a federal grant, we can't match that. It's already federal dollars. But if we can get a private grant, we can get match dollars there. We do a lot of our grant activities are to get information for the state, and so back in the days of OHP2, when we were changing the health plan, some of our dollars came in to go back out again from a grant out to an actuary to do some modeling or a health economist to do some consulting. As we've been getting more and more requests about information, especially with the current health reform efforts going on, we've worked closely with Senator Bates' commission over the interim and have provided consulting with him, done presentations for them, as well as our own health policy commission to try to provide as much information as we can using maximizing our funding as best we can.
Representative Crummell had a question that he was trying to wait until you ran out of breath.
Since I was running more than
thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious about this, and again, this is something that you can bring the answer back to us. But under your budget drivers, where you were just talking about the general fund dollars leveraging to maximize federal match, I was in a meeting, I believe it was Thursday, with Congresswoman Hooley, and she's now part of the healthcare subcommittee. And one of the things that she was talking about was that Oregon was leaving about $130 million on the table, that we were not a federal match money, that we weren't pulling in. And I'm just wondering if you could help us understand what we would need to do. And she was talking about it being on a 75% match, so 75% of federal dollars, 25% state. And so I'm just wondering if you could help us understand what we can do to make sure that we're not leaving federal money laying on the table with regards to health care and Medicaid and all of those sorts of things. And again, you don't need to answer here, but if you can get back to us.
Chair Jensen, Representative Crummell, I just note that the Health Policy Commission has been looking at how to maximize Medicaid dollars, and that's part of their report that's going to be coming out in the next week. And that's also work we've been doing with the Department of Human Services to try to understand, you know, how much did you have to put in for state dollars to get pull down that additional match, and then where are there areas where we could maximize match?
Thank you.
Page 354, funding source, as I mentioned, general fund leveraged when possible. We have a series of agreements with DHS to do some of their evaluation activities. We primarily the senior care facilities for the seniors and persons with disability. We do assisted living surveys, nursing facilities surveys. We collect
Mr. Chair, what kind of surveys? What all are you asking?
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, we've been asked by SPD to look at, see, you know, what are the types of diagnoses of people admitted to the assisted living, what's the capacity of the assisted living facility and nursing home, trying to get them in some ways a little bit demographic about what's going on in the state of long-term care.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Do you guys also maintain the cancer registry?
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, no, that's the Public Health Division within the Department of Human Services that does that.
Thank you.
354, we are able to collect fees for some of our data collection, and we are doing that this biennium around ambulatory or outpatient hospital facilities. And then, as I said, we have grant dollars. The pie chart on 355 shows a breakdown of our expenditures. That special payments is the money that we sent when we send general fund over to the Department of Human Services. The services and supplies is there, includes some of those professional fees that we use to buy actuarial modeling and economic analysis.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry to beat the survey thing to death, but it just seems like it's such valuable information. Over the last 6 months, I've spent an enormous number of hours sitting in ERs.
I'm sorry.
just trying to get some sense of the demographic going through these ERs. Do you collect that kind of data?
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, the emergency room data is a massive quantity of data, and we don't currently collect all of it. However, because of a grant we had through the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, we work closely with Dr. Bob Lowe at OHSU, who went and did a statewide collection of who was in the emergency room following the changes in the Oregon Health Plan in 2003, and we saw a rise in the number of uninsured coming into the emergency room, a decline in the number in Medicaid, and that was like a one-time major data collection to be able to get all of that data. Some of the smaller rural hospitals, it was a challenge to get some of that data. We tried to do a representative sample. We couldn't get every single emergency room in the state. It's a massive number of visits. And so some states, there's a handful of them that do collect the emergency room. We're able to get all of the hospital discharges, who gets in and actually admitted, but the actual, all the ER data on an ongoing basis is very huge and very expensive.
Mr. Chair, the point that I'm trying to get to is that we're predicating a lot of policy decisions on perceptions of use of ERs. Anecdotally, having, as I just said, spent hours sitting there, it's amazing to me what one sees in a busy urban ER, and the one I'm specifically thinking about is OHSU. But to collect that data to validate some of the, what I'm getting at is, does the data exist to validate the assertion that absent some kind of state-provided health coverage, this huge cost shift is occurring because so many uninsured are using ERs? And I'm trying to get a sense of the profile of people using ERs. Are they largely children? Are they largely seniors? Are they routine health coverage for the flu? Or are they actual ERs where somebody's run their hand through a table saw kind of stuff? I'm really looking for the amalgamation of all of that data so that from the busy urban ERs, whether they're urban in Medford, urban in Bend, urban in Portland, you can begin to get a profile of what the people streaming through those doors look like.
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, I should send you our, we did do a survey sitting, we actually paid medical students to sit and survey who was sitting in the emergency room shortly after the changes in the health plan, and can send you a snapshot of what they're seeing. I can also send you Dr. Lowe's analysis of what he saw statewide to give you kind of a snapshot. But I agree, those are important things that we need to have a better handle on, and it is, as I said, just a huge, huge data collection undertaking to have it on a daily, regular basis, but we'd love to have it to better understand that.
Fascinating information. One of the days that we were there, there were transactions being conducted in at least 5 different languages, and it was just interesting to note how complex those ERs are.
Yes.
Page
356, we'll move on, is our overview of our budget, and I'll move on, and then we have our quality improvement efforts and our future direction. I'll move forward to our policy packages. There's a corrected some pages for your packet when we get to the policy option packages, but for package 070 is our revenue shortfall. Because of previous cuts to our general fund, we were directed to go out and get grants. We got some grants, and luckily there was a huge one coming out of the federal government over the last 4 or 5 years. We've been lucky enough to be one of those states getting those dollars. However, President Bush has zeroed those out for the last 2 federal fiscal years, and those grants are no longer continuing. We also had some private grants, and we've used those up, and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation is not doing any further single state grants opportunities. They will do small, very selected evaluations, but not large on the scale in which we got before. And as we also had a small prescription settlement grant that helped support the Oregon Prescription Drug Program to do some of its outreach and networking development that it provided some project management. So unfortunately, if we have a significant revenue shortfall because of those changes in our budget. Package 082 is a continuation of things that were okay approved by the June 2006 Emergency Board, which was increasing our limitations so we could collect that fee on those ambulatory or outpatient hospital services. And to use our second year of a grant we did get from another prescription drug settlement to do some targeted curriculum development with providers to try to get them this evidence-based evaluation of prescription drugs. And that's what Package 082 consists of. And then as the new pages that you have show, there's Policy Package 161, and then there's Policy Package 163. those two together, for the most part, fulfill that revenue shortfall. We're not asking to replace a big growth of state government. We're just wanting to maintain the functions in which we've been asked to follow out our statutory obligations. We've been given the Medicaid Advisory Committee since we've had those cuts in general fund, and we sort of have been supporting that through these grant dollars that are no longer in existence, and we're asking here for some dollars to try to maintain those functions and also to continue that coordination of electronic health records to make sure that there's a broad adoption of electronic health records across the state and that they can talk to each other. Sometimes everybody buys their own electronic health records, but they don't talk to each other, and you can't share information. So Policy Package 161 will allow us to is related to providing you with better data, as well as, of course, customer service. And we currently, as I said, have been doing pretty well at 83%, but we think in order to reach that 90%, we're going to need to have the support through that Policy Package 161. Policy Package 163, Oregon Prescription Drug Program. As I said, this was a program started back in the 03-05 biennium. We've been given funding for one person to run this program, and we have, as an office, have tried to cobble together some additional help to help her put that program together, and this is to kind of give them a little bit more sort of business startup costs. I mean, ideally, you'd ask, why isn't this self-sustaining? Well, with only 10,000 enrollees at the moment, that's not enough to spread the costs without cutting the amount of discount that each of those people could receive and would discourage them perhaps from buying that drug, and from public groups from wanting to use this program in their purchase of prescription drug coverage. When we get a more critical mass, 100,000 or higher, it's very possible. The small investment here, potentially in just by June 07, we anticipate there'd probably be about $3 million in savings to individuals in Oregon who sign up to be part of this program. If you think of $28 per prescription each month, if you total that up, we can provide to the taxpayers a major savings for this small startup. Eventually, we won't need to be asking you for dollars for this, and we'll be able to self-sustain. And as we partnering with Washington State has led to a very great but somewhat complex contract to try to share any additional costs around as best we can. And I think Idaho is interested, Montana is interested, and it's possible this could grow even broader and wider. But at least the governor felt that there was still a need for some business startup costs here in this year. And that ties back to our key performance measure of customer service to the citizens of Oregon.
Thank you. You're out of breath. That's something you'll say.
No, sir.
Okay. No concluding questions, except an observation that I had. We did a survey on kits for the governor's office, and I find it interesting. You must have included in that survey 19 since the governor's package came out, helping kids with 19-year-olds is part of the formula, part of the group included.
Chair Jensen, it's up to the age of 19.
To the age of 19. 19. Well, I just find it interesting that 18 years old is a sufficient age to be in the Oregon National Guard and to find yourself in the park. Hardly what I would consider kids.
Chair Jensen, the reason that's included was the Medicaid pays up to that rate in order to pull down the federal dollars. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Jean.
Good morning.
How are you this morning?
I'm fine, thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jean Thorne. I'm the administrator of the Public Employees Benefit Board, and our presentation begins on page 367. PEB is established by statute, and we are responsible for purchasing of health care coverage and other coverage for all state and university employees and their dependents. We are the state's largest employer-based purchaser, and so we cover about 120,000 lives. On page 368, you'll see our organization chart. We currently have 17 positions. Most of them that you'll see on the bottom really are working directly with agencies, with the payroll and benefits staff, and directly with members. Our customers, we would say, are both the agency payroll staff and the members directly. We do have one position, a program development position, that works with our board and with our health plans and trying to look at longer-range planning, which I'll be talking about in a moment. We are governed by statute by our board. It is an 8-member board appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate. The administrator serves at the pleasure of the board. There are 4 management representatives, 2 of which are by position, including Dr. Smith as administrator of the Office of Health Policy and Research. 4 non-management representatives, and there are 2 members of the Legislative Assembly who are non-voting members. We have a number of programs or benefits that we are responsible for. Medical, dental, life insurance, long-term care, disability, accidental death, and dismemberment. We also administer dependent care and health care flexible spending accounts where members can put money away pre-tax and then reimburse themselves for expenses. And then also provide coverage to those who are leaving employment through what's called COBRA, and also non-Medicare retiree plans. The budgets for the purchase of the services are actually included in the agency budget. So, for instance, all the DHS employees, the budgets for the purchase of those benefits are included in the DHS budget.
Just a quick question, Jane. The dependent care I'm familiar with the terminology of long-term tax sheltered annuities. That's not what it is in your case. The money set aside by employees for retirement purposes other than the PERS is part of your jurisdiction. Is that right?
No, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure.
Deferred compensation.
Oh, deferred compensation is operated through PERS. PERS actually operates the Orient Savings Growth Plan.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. Actually, if I could, this was out of order a bit, but if I could have you go to page 372, and then we'll come back to 371. Our board established a strategic vision back in December of 2002, and that really has guided their work since then. And the board really felt that as the largest purchaser in the state, we should play a catalytic role in trying to see what could we do to try to get some change or incent change in the healthcare delivery system. We knew we were spending a lot of money, but what were we getting for it? And so there were a number of components that were part of this vision, an innovative delivery system and community statewide that provides evidence-based medicine. What could we do to create incentives to have providers follow evidence-based medicine guidelines? We wanted to look at improving quality and outcomes, not just delivering health care services, but what are we getting for those services? What are the outcomes? The need to promote consumer education, healthy behaviors, and informed choices. Much of what we need to do is really engage our members in helping them make choices and helping support healthier lifestyles as well, so that some of the issues that may end up being paid for through the healthcare system can be avoided. We need to have appropriate incentives and transparency as well. So if you go back to page 371, in terms of our major accomplishments, this has really been...
Gene, what kind of incentives?
Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, I think, for instance, one of the things we did this time was establish a new plan design around prescription drugs to create incentives for members to work with their physicians to see if a generic drug or a lower-cost brand-name drug was more appropriate. And we have, because we made the cost of the non-preferred drugs something noticeable to them, and we have seen quite a shift in the use of generics because of that. And we are now embarking with our health plans in looking at changes for 2008 that may include some incentives around how, for instance, for diabetics. Are there some incentives that they might propose that would encourage diabetic members to take better care of themselves? It may be if they follow through with certain things, maybe they have a copay waived.
Thanks, Jean. I understand what an incentive is. I still don't know what they are that you're offering.
Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, when I'm using the term incentives, in this case it really is around how do we, what kind of copays may we require? So we have lower copays for generics, higher copays for non-preferred drugs, for instance. This was a major undertaking of really embarking on selecting health plans based on this strategic vision. So we did undertake that, and we now have, beginning in 2006, we have four health plans that have agreed to move forward on the vision. We then worked with those four health plans to establish specific health plan performance measures. We talk about outcomes, but if you're not even measuring it in the first place, it's hard to know how you're improving. So together with them, there are 13 system process measures and 32 clinical measures, and they may relate to processes or outcomes. So, for instance, it may relate to our appropriate screenings being done for diabetics, but on the outcome side, for instance, our cholesterol levels really being controlled. So there are a number of measures here that we will be seeing some of the first reports out later this year. We also worked with DHS Public Health to conduct the first statistically valid survey of our PEB enrollees to really get at what are some of the underlying health conditions and health risks that they have. This was to serve as a baseline survey. We received the results in fall of 2005 and then intend to have that survey every 2 years to really see, are we seeing improvements in the health of our enrollees?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gene, what was the level of confidence on the survey?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, I'll look that up, but I believe it was a 95% confidence level. It was a phone survey, random, 1,500 employees from state agencies and 500 from the university system.
Thank you.
We implemented our online benefit management system called PEB.Benefits. Previously, we had a paper process, lots of forms floating through the mail needing to be entered manually by agency staff. This was a huge undertaking. We are now able to pull in information from 17 different databases across state agencies, universities, and vendors. And yes, I did hear Representative Crummell's question on the first day about, is it easier to use now than it was when it was first brought up? Yes, it is, but there are continuing to be enhancements that we believe, together with the agencies, will make it easier for members and also easier for the agencies, and I'll detail some of those. We have a specific policy option package around that, but I think if you were to go in today, you would find it easier to get in, easier to find your way around. The buttons are more understandable, and so a number of changes have been made since we first implemented that.
And, Mr. Chair, if I may add to that, and it does actually do what it's supposed to when you get to the end, so you know that you've actually got to the end and the information's been recorded?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, that's exactly one of the things that we do need. It shows you what it has been saved or not, so you understand, yes.
Okay,
that
you.
We brought this up as we were doing a mandatory open enrollment for almost all of our members. So although it had been tested, when you suddenly have 30,000 people in using it, you find that there were improvements that were necessary.
I can tell you, Mr. Chair, not only was it frustrating for me, but I had a number of employee constituents that called me, and it was frustrating for them as well. So I'm glad to hear that that's been fixed.
We have consolidated our open enrollment materials, which has allowed us to reduce printing and mailing costs. We've moved more and more to the online information and enrollment. And we are now in the process of selecting dental plans based on the board's strategic vision. We have a request for proposals out right now and are asking dental plans what they could do to support the vision as well. If we go to page 373 then, as with the other divisions of DAS, we are supporting the four primary goals from the DAS strategic plan: customer service, effective policies, efficient and effective government operations, infrastructure and adaptive government.
In what little time we have left, I'm listening to your presentation. It sounds like PEB is doing well. You've got form consolidation. You're tracking data. You've got good incentives. You've got good performance measures. You've got the participating health plans playing well. You've got a bureaucracy in place. You've got competent administration in you. You seem to have an engaged board. So why is it that PEB is not being considered as a repository for this healthcare consolidated insurance program? Why are we building a new bureaucracy when it seems to me that by demonstrated in your performance and your materials and your competent administration of PEB that that would be a good place? Why are we building a new bureaucratic superstructure when that educators pool could be housed with you?
Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, it is going to be housed with us, and that is that you'll see there's
Let
a package.
Let me be more direct, not housed. Be part of?
Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, the governor's office concept is that there would be two boards, but that the staff would all report to the PEB administrator. And so it would more than double what we already have in terms of workload and be working with 198 school districts. But the functions are similar. And so the final package you'll see here in the PEB budget is to bring in or bring up the Educators Benefit Board.
I guess I haven't asked this directly enough. Why two boards? Why not just have the educators pulled into PEB?
Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, I think that probably is a question that would best be directed at the governor's office. What I could tell you, though, is that because PEB is a separate board, our PEB board, the makeup is reflective of state agency workforce. So when you look at, for instance, the non-management representatives, two are from the largest union, which is SEIU, one from the next largest, which is AFSCME, and then a fourth, which is an at-large. The Educators Benefit Board, representatives there on the management side are from school board, school district management, from the labor unions that represent the school district workforce. And so I believe that was the recognizing, although the functions are similar, that the makeup of who would be covered is different than what we have under the current PEB board.
Follow. How is the makeup different? I mean, other than the definitions of the union representatives, how are they different?
Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, I would say that in terms of some of the workforce issues, well, the management certainly is different, that we are in state government, we are under basically one management structure. With the Educators Benefit Board, there are 198 school districts. And in looking at the workforce itself, that the span of the types of occupations that would be encompassed, and frankly, as our board, as the PEB board looks at the needs of state government employees, it really is recognizing we have a broad spectrum of occupations, of health conditions, and situations in which our members participate. We have people working for the Department of Forestry. We have professors at the universities. And so that there are differences in terms of the makeup. There are differences in terms of the local management as well.
Makeup being that school teachers are healthier, not healthier than guys working for ODF&W? I don't know what you're telling me.
Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, that the health conditions may be different, and that we have a broader span that we have. And what we are really doing at this point with PEB is trying to look at what are the demographics of our membership and then having plan designs that really address those issues.
Couldn't you add a plan design? I mean, you've got four plans. Why not five? I guess I just don't buy the fact that somehow the demographic of government agencies that go all the way from guys keeping the passes open during the winter, that's demonstrably different from people working in schools, OSEA, and I mean, there's a broad spectrum there too. You've got all sorts of people doing all sorts of stuff, and I'm trying to buy the argument that somehow the profile of state agency workers is different than the profile of educators.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, I have not been involved in the discussions on the Educators Benefit Board over the years, and I think those discussions actually began before I came to PEP, so I think some of the decisions around having benefit boards are ones that I'm trying to provide you the information that what I understand, but those are discussions that have been occurring in the governor's office.
Chair Jensen, I suggest that you allow us to do a little bit of legwork with Jim Sager, the advisor on education to the governor, and I think he can give us a very specific answer as to how this is designed as two separate distinct boards, and we'll get that back to you.
I think that's probably true, but I think you cut to the quick on this. To not design it as two different boards, it probably doesn't have any chance of survival. That's probably critical for its survival, for it ever getting off the ground, I guess, is dramatic, because I'm afraid the opposition, whether we're talking about from the teachers or whether we're talking about from the other groups, may be much too large and too much noise made in the building to proceed with it. So I think, Senator, and I know it's terrible to say this in this building, but I think there may be an element of political in relationship to that.
Say it ain't so.
Politics in the Capitol?
How dare you suggest that, Mr. Chair?
I'm sorry. I'd certainly welcome that to perhaps help us, a little bit with Senator Johnson's concerns. But I'm sure one of the things that you will find that there is a perception on the part of probably both PEP members as well as educators of a very distinct difference, and they would not be comfortable. Whether they should or not, that's another question. And really not relevant when it comes to getting the issue through the building.
Well, Chair, as we've all seen many times over, a newly formed group, organization, usually wants their distinct representation. And then in time, that can move into a different, system in a few years with comfort recognized.
And an old group who is about to absorb the new group does not want to give up any of its turf in the process of doing it.
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Hey, Mr. Chair, just as a final note on that, I do think our board has expressed concerns that they want to keep. We're really at the beginning of some very exciting times now, working closely with the delivery system and really trying to incent change and want to continue moving down that road. And a new board bringing up the educator's benefits, there will be many, many implementation issues. There are numerous issues, and I think part of it is also an issue of momentum, of wanting to make sure we can continue to move down the road that the PEP board is already moving down and not be held back so that we can continue working on those two different operations.
I assume, Dean, if you're so thrilled with being here to talk to us about this budget that you'd like to come back tomorrow.
I would just love to come back tomorrow, Mr. Chair, and if that's where you'd like to end this, probably a good place.
I think we'll stop for the day and continue again tomorrow. Thank you very much.
See you tomorrow.
With that, we're...